We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Diego Parrilla, author, mining and petroleum engineer, and economist. He's also a portfolio manager at Quadriga, focused on global macro volatility and tail risk. Thanks for joining me today, Diego.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you back. And, you know, we have a lot to go over today. You wrote in your latest letter that you called the anti-bubble report, positioning for a volatile and hostile Q4 2022. So is there a particular reason that you see Q4 going to be more hostile and volatile than the rest of the year?
Well, I guess it's a confluence of factors. But if you look at the hiking cycle from the Fed, which has been leading the way globally, it's approaching its peak into early Q1. There's a reason for that. To some extent, how high can we go, and the fact that they've done it so fast with what we would call jumbo hikes of 75 basis points, which would have been inconceivable almost a year ago. Shows you that the combination of the size, the cumulative size, the individual size, the speed, I think it's putting a significant amount of pressure in the market. Some of which it's happening within the U.S., some of it which is happening outside of the U.S. One of the key drivers has been the dollar, which is taking a bit of a relief. Another one has been equity markets, which have also taken a bit of a relief. And I think inflation, which is also, albeit a tiny relief, has had some relief. So I think we're now probably heading into the last few hikes in the year, perhaps not as aggressive as before, but adding to what are already very high levels, which in my view are adding and likely to add some further strain. So if we look back at recent history and what happened in Q4 2018, we had a bit of a similar situation where you had a Fed that was sort of in autopilot, you know, hiking, and things started to crumble already at 2.5%. So the market had expectations that we might go significantly higher, and that didn't happen. So I think the fact that these hikes happened so fast and so large means that we've climbed a long way in a way, not giving enough time for certain things to be swallowed or adjusted. And so I think some of the delayed effect of these hikes are coming to test the real strength of the system. And in my view, you know, as we head into December with a couple more hikes, I think this is going to be more evident. So it is, again, something that's building up throughout the year, and that, in my opinion, might basically lead to more volatility, not less. Mm-hmm.
Diego, one thing I've been trying to get several guests' idea about is how long you think that these rate hikes will actually, let's say the damage from these rate hikes will actually take to work their way through the markets and the economy. How long do you see that lag effect taking, and where do you think those effects will be seen once they start to really manifest themselves?
Well, I think the starting point is the damage was already done. So I think we're starting from the position where it was what economists would call pre-existent fragility. So you know, in that sense, there are plenty of pockets of weakness, and it's impossible to know with any degree of certainty exactly what's going to pop first. And we have a number of exogenous or factors that are contributing to this complicated situation, including a war and significant issues on the commodity markets and its implications to shortages as well as price inflation. So in that sense, those factors could lead and end up one way or another. It could stay as it is. It could get significantly worse, or it could also be significantly better. So, but ultimately, I think in some ways, the fact that these hikes have been so aggressive, so fast, etc., show, if I may say so, the sheer incompetence of not doing anything for so long, right? Mm-hmm. So it's showing, it's putting into perspective and evidence, you know, the complacency of central banks with fighting inflation. And so we've been neglecting the problem for a while, which many of us knew it was already a major issue. And I think this late response and the fact that it's happening so fast is risking things. Well, how far can it go? I don't think it will go significantly higher in terms of before things start to crack. Mm-hmm. How long will it last, and how aggressive is the potential reversal or the pivot? It's obviously going to be a function of how markets react. And I think beyond the price action in the equity markets, we need to pay close attention to the credit markets. And that in some ways is going to be also closely linked to the currency markets, because as you borrowed a ton more than you could afford and arguably in the wrong currency. So, you know, nobody would lend you in your own local currency. You end up borrowing in dollars, which rates are going to stay low forever. And that misconception perhaps led to people to be over-levered and more sensitive. So I think we could do the numbers and see who is obviously exposed to this, but there are significant other levels of hidden leverage. I mean, look at the UK, just mm-hmm. You know, the pension fund industry just a few weeks ago. And you know, that kind of surprised most of us in terms of, you know, the as not arguably being one of the obvious pockets of trouble, and very quickly turned out to be, you know, potentially systemic, forcing the intervention of the central banks. And I think that dynamic could repeat itself from pockets that we may or may not fully anticipate. And therefore, if, you know, I'm happy to be proven wrong, you know, but if the system was able to cope and there's no major stress in the system, and turns out that, you know, our growth is robust and healthy, and you know, we can cope with all these without things imploding, then happy days. But mm-hmm. my sense is these things are going to are already happening, and there's a risk. And B, once they go, they're significantly more interconnected, and so the system is, in my opinion, more fragile. Again, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know exactly which thing's going to go first, but I think that combination of, you know, volatility and currency and credit and equity and duration and all these other components can actually expose some of these weaknesses, which means, you know, the reversal could be significant. But I actually don't think that even if we went into I'm starting to think that or hope that central banks in some ways have learned their lesson and the dangers of having zero or even negative nominal yields, in the sense that we are building a system with infinite duration. So the present value of cash flows is par at zero or greater than par at negative rates. And this kind of dynamic is extraordinarily dangerous because it creates these artificially high valuations, these bubbles, and that creates wealth effect. And this is obviously artificial. And so all the benefits you get from these things on the way up, you get compounded as pain on the way down mm-hmm. As you get this gross misallocation. So it's going to be, I think, in that sense, something to watch. And again, I think for the reasons we discussed before, we may not be that far away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think an interesting way that you kind of summarized that in the letter was that we've only seen the central banks delay, transform, and enlarge monetary and fiscal problems. And really, as you say, it has created all of those outsized outcomes, right? But you know, as you're mentioning the wealth effect, why is the Fed, let's say, more worried about not tightening enough? Is that to do with the wealth effect?
Well, I think the rhetoric from Powell has changed. I think in the past few years, you could see the Fed influenced by Trump in one way or another, being very focused on equity markets and 401ks and all this kind of stuff, right? I think Powell could have not been more direct in his latest, basically comments after the Fed meeting. And he is talking about the pain and that might be needed for as they react forcefully to this risk. So I do think he's changed his approach. It's in some ways the discipline that they've been lacking that is being imposed. I would argue that it might be too little too late as we face this impossible equilibrium or fight between bubbles too big to fail and inflation, because at the end of the day, everything revolves around inflation. It's not just so much about the war or commodity prices or cycles or bottlenecks. Inflation is really a monetary phenomenon. And I think as we head into this new phase, there's a perception that central banks are tightening and perhaps will be printing less or in fact removing liquidity. I think the future will lead to more, not less printing through perhaps one of the key things people must understand today, which is yield curve control, YCC. Mm-hmm. And there's a, as we transition from the past decades of QE, which was basically, hello, Mr. Powell, here's $120 billion a month. Come on, go and spend it. And, when someone gives you that money and you buy, bonds, fixed income, you're artificially bringing interest rates down. You are artificially bringing valuations up and you create the problem. As you said, I think as we move into the next phase, that amount of debt is so huge that you cannot normalize monetary policy because you no longer have a $1 million mortgage, you have a $100 million or $10 million or whatever you decided to embark on. And as we do that, and those bubbles are there, I think the only way to sustain the system eventually will be by giving the central banks effectively blank checks in the form of yield curve control. And we're already seeing that in Japan, and the currency has been the degree of freedom with a pretty brutal devaluation of the yen, and ironically cynically rather, what you see is that printing created a problem of inflation. You tried to fight inflation by hiking stuff. Those hikes exposed the bubbles that you created in the first place, and as you tried to prevent those bubbles from imploding, you need to print more and devalue, and that brings back inflation. So it's going to be a pretty impossible, I think, balance, for central banks. And right now, the focus is to fight inflation, hoping that we can contain it without having to step in the monetary response and hoping that this doesn't become systemic. And that is what we are all hoping for. If anything breaks in the process, and there are, as we discussed earlier, plenty of candidates, I think there's going to be no choice than to actually have to contain this. Now, look at beyond Japan, look at Europe, right? Europe is also leading the way. They hike rates, from negative to zero, and then from zero to 75, and now 1.5. But as we move there, the central bank also introduced a form of yield curve control, which is a TPI, the anti-fragmentation tool. Mm-hmm. And basically what it means is, okay, guys, I need to hike rates. They were too low. I need to fight inflation, but I'm not going to let these higher rates blow up Spain or Italy or whoever. And so in preparation for that, you're introducing a mechanism by which you can print money and support this in infinite size. And so as you do that, you are once again transforming the problem, you know, what was effectively a credit problem into printing inflation and devaluation. And that brings you back. So it's this fallacy that sets the foundation of my thesis, the anti-bubble thesis. It's really that idea. Come on, guys, you know, don't fool yourselves. You know, printing money and taking debt, monitoring fiscal policies without limits do not solve the problems. As you said earlier, from my quote in the letter, we're delaying, transferring, transforming, and enlarging those problems. And I think we've gone so far and created such distortions that, you know, trying to normalize things, it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, at least without significant amount of pain in one way or another, be it in the form of, you know, wealth effect by destroying this artificial setup where we all thought we were super rich, so you write that off, or through inflation, which basically shows you that your you know, the purchase power of that is being diluted. And I think these are not, neither of them is a good scenario, but wealth, I mean, inflation is probably worse because ultimately creates, you know, inequality, it creates huge social issues, social unrest, populism, extremism. And, you know, as Ray Dalio would point out, these things tend to lead to bigger problems, you know, God forbid. So it's all, unfortunately, you know, a consequence of abusive monetary and fiscal policies, complacent central banks that they thought they knew better and they ignored, you know, the obvious effect of inflation, maybe fooled by some deflationary pressures through some short-term effects, but it's all been exposed. And so I sincerely hope, as I always dedicate my book, that I'll be proven wrong, but I suspect that, you know, many of these things are unfortunately ahead of us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really seems like the central banks have just basically backed themselves into a corner, and there's no way out except to absolutely devalue the currency from here, whether that be by, you know, keep printing debt, yield curve control, or any combination of all of these different issues. It just seems like this path is very predetermined in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But Diego, I'd like to get your thoughts on how the lack of energy is going to affect Europe as well. You know, considering they have euros, but no actual molecules of gas, won't they just end up printing the difference and end up again with a larger problem than they do right now?
Yeah, the energy situation is very interesting because it kind of reinforces the thesis we discussed, right? So we have a problem that has been created for a long time. You know, it's lack of energy infrastructure, lack of production capacity, ESG policies that penalize hydrocarbons, etc. And then you have obviously, you know, reliance of the production from places like Russia, particularly acute for Germany. This is nothing new. It's been basically the seeds have been planted for decades, right? And then one day you realize that you have this problem. As you mentioned, there are two dimensions to the problem. One is the access to the physical molecules of you know, crude or gas or whatever. And the second one is the price. When it comes down to the physical molecules, you know, governments are first and foremost are going to, they will want energy security, just like we want food security. And this problem often, you know, feeds on itself because, you know, I want my food to stay in my country. I want my energy to stay in my country. And so you will see hoarding of both producers as well as consumers on the physical side, building cushions that make sure their countries will not freeze to death or starve to death. And so at the end of the day, this is very, very important. The second dimension, which is the prices, when you introduce energy subsidies, what you're effectively saying is, look, pay something you can afford. I'll take care of the rest. And that I will take care of the rest is not fool ourselves. You're just literally, you're not going to do it by higher taxes necessarily. Or if you do by taxing the energy guys, then you are exacerbating the problem of production capacity because they have no money to reinvest and the problem perpetuates itself. And if you try to do it through taxes on people that are already hurting, then you have an issue, you go for the wealthy. So the easiest thing is generally, of course, tax the wealthy, but also to print money. And you are, again, printing money and taking debt to subsidize these energy prices. And Europe, since the summer, the situation has been, we all knew how difficult this winter could be. And therefore, the prices that we were willing to pay to attract those molecules and to and paid handsomely for them were unprecedented. So Europe has been paying incredible high prices, almost 10x what the US was paying for natural gas equivalent, and significantly, 3x or more in crude oil prices, which effectively have a purpose, which is let's fill up the coffer, let's fill up the storage. And then, just a few weeks ago, we had sort of mission accomplished. So we managed to in the middle of a war, to head into the winter with full natural gas storage. That has been an incredible relief for energy markets in Europe, as well as the actual financial markets, because it's reducing, these shortages that affect the economy. Think about a German manufacturer that requires those molecules to produce, but also from a price perspective. So Europe, in a way, miscalculated badly, then it had to react very aggressively. Yeah, we pay those huge prices, mm-hmm. but in some ways, it's in a stronger position than it was a few months ago. And so we'll see how tough the winter is. So far, it's been relatively mild, although things are changing and there are risks of perhaps colder than average winter in a number of parts of the world with a bit of a La Niña effect. So we should not relax, but certainly the markets have reacted forcefully. And also, we've introduced a number of measures that seek to contain demand and hopefully reduce that risk in Europe. But the reality is, these are not issues that you will solve quickly or easily. It's going to take, many years for Europe to properly solve the problem, with or without Russia. Back in the question, mm-hmm. this lack of trust is already the trust has been broken. So these investments are and will be taking place. It will take years. In the meantime, I think Europe and to a large extent also Asia will be less competitive than places like the US, which have been enjoying the benefits of having cheaper, more abundant, reliable energy. I think to summarize, energy is and will continue to be a problem. It has not been solved. It's been, transferred and transformed, and I think we gained some time, and hopefully we'll see things finding a positive resolution. But energy is at the core of the key aspects that determine the global competitiveness, and I think here the U.S. Once again it seems to be in a stronger position. On that front, and that has implications across many other areas, including the currency, as we discussed, through subsidies and other considerations. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's try and look at this from the other side, like from Russia's side. It has the energy to export and relies on that the sale of that energy to fund itself. So does that also come under distress when trying to find, let's say, longer term demand for its energy and commodities, or is that demand going to be there regardless because all of these countries need that energy and commodities, let's say, despite the sanctions?
Well, look, of course, I think the bad guy is the good guy from his own movie, right? And Russia has its own side of the story. And I think this history tells us that these huge volatility events that create this uncertainty and this lack of trust eventually lead to overcapacity. And I think, you know, that the West needs Russian gas as much as, you know, Russian gas needs the West. And I think this, I mean, my humble opinion is that I think Russia got into this with their eyes open. They knew that there might be some sort of response. I don't think they thought Europe would go that far and they would really be willing to suffer as much as it's done and could do, you know, for Ukraine. And I think that miscalculation perhaps might have led to thinking that, you know, this was just too precious to fight. They might be able to get away with stuff quicker. And since then, the situation has actually, you know, turned even more polarized. So, of course, plan A for Russia might have been another Crimea, you know, a quick entry. I get this stuff, you know, who cares that you still need my gas, I need yours, fine. But beyond that, I think it was very obvious that Russia needs an exit for the gas and their energy and all the other commodities, by the way. And that, I think it's more obvious than ever that with the current regimes and the current setup, it's more likely to head east than west. Mm-hmm. Of course, China and India and others will need this. And, you know, getting or being in a position to be able to take that is or being sanctioned or compliant, I think it's to be seen. But yeah, Russia is a huge powerhouse for many commodities. The current setup means that you cannot count on those necessarily, which means that you're gonna create the incentives and, you know, the destroy demand and create supply and do all sorts of substitution and efficiencies to be in a situation where you can actually, you know, go ahead without them. And ultimately, being very positive about the world and, you know, hoping that things find some sort of peaceful resolution and a happy ending, I think the damage is already done. That investment will go ahead and the world will be facing significant overcapacity in all fronts, from production to transportation to storage, and that could lead to much lower prices in the medium long term, with much lower volatility, and that's historically been the case. I mean, it's almost this super bleak outlook about prices and quantities and prices that leads us to make these huge investments. And then as things get resolved in one way or another, then you get those balances, that excess capacity to lead to lower prices. And these are how super cycles are made. And we've seen them over and over. So that's I think, how these things are going to play out. In the short term, our perspective is what it is marked by the war and a number of things, but taking a more medium, long-term perspective, you know, I'd like to be more optimistic. Now, having said that, there are these challenges from the monetary side, which might lead to more printing. So ultimately, real assets that are scarce or that, you know, like oil or others, I think could see significantly higher prices in the longer term. But part of that is due to its own merits, being physical and scarce, and part of it is due to the demerits of the currency we use in the denominator, which I think, in my view, will continue to see and experience devaluations, as we discussed in the previous questions. Mm-hmm.
Does that add, let's say, the trend of onshoring and deglobalization continue to add to that inflationary side of the equation in your eyes, Diego?
Sure, that's very important. I think the world, again, that's one of the big trends, right? For decades, we had this globalization, accessing very cheap labor and relying increasingly more into on-demand type of stuff, processes that were super optimized, and you could count on getting your chips for your car in Germany from Taiwan within on short notice, and suddenly the combination of the pandemic and the war and several other things highlight the dependency of these bottlenecks. And so once again, I think the market defends itself. It will. It's already anything that is remotely strategic is being addressed. And you're going to, of course, build the factories in places where perhaps, things are not as cheap, but security is more important than efficiency or profitability, rather. So faced with that dilemma, we'll always face security rather than profitability, especially at a government level, where that's the only point. And so they are the ones who control regulation, etc., and it will make their life more difficult, either directly or indirectly. As a corporate, you might want to over optimize your profits, but if you're imposed tariffs on certain things, top down, then that will influence your decision. So I think all the stars are aligned for the world to deglobalize in some ways. And I think, you look at the trends and who benefited from one, it's something that could likely move the other way. So, but that is for sure something to watch as this inflation versus deflation debate takes place. And similarly to what we discussed on the energy markets, there are cycles, where short-term tightness leads to, short-term shortages and short-term volatility lead to long-term oversupply, excess, and lower volatility. I think, likewise, it's something to understand on the inflationary side. But again, we need to understand that the real source of inflation is monetary, not necessarily these cycles on the physical side. Or economic cycles.
Diego, do you think China is in a different position in some ways? They have massive trade surpluses, yet, as you write, one of the greatest bubbles in history and a potential source of systemic risk. So why do you see them posing that threat to the global system?
Well, look, I do believe that China has followed a model of growth that has led to incredible results. We'll see at what price. But, the centralized growth model where you have so many things that are managed in a rigid basis, whether it was for a long time, the one-child policy or the FX exchange rate, the transmission of monetary policy and credit through the SOEs, climate, whatever you want, all these different degrees of rigidity, where you must grow at 8.8% because I say so, lead to potentially misallocations of capital, right? They lead to a lot of things that are not being able to adjust freely by market forces. There is a perception that China is this very, very strong, it's like, I use the analogy like a concrete, a skyscraper made out of concrete. It looks very sturdy, very strong. But I think if you pay attention to the skyscrapers, the real strong ones are, they look like rubble, like rubber, in Tokyo, right? So I think it's about that ability to absorb and adjust these earthquakes and these shocks, and I feel that a lot of the growth, the deflation, but the growth, the source of demand from the urbanization of 400 million people, the all these mega trends that we've seen in China that may have led to you know, a bubble in real estate, in credit, in infrastructure, which happened in magically with currency that was surprisingly stable and et cetera, et cetera. I think this has all been feeding into a lot of inflation and issues domestically that are like a volcano, right? You know, they can erupt and they're being suppressed. So time will tell. I think the degree of freedom of the system, pretty much 100% of the time, it's always the exchange rate. So you could look at Venezuela or Argentina or Turkey or whoever you want, Zimbabwe or Japan or Europe or others, that they say, look, I can do whatever I want. I can, you know, increase my debt at infinitum. I can do whatever I want with interest rates. I can, you know, support companies. I can subsidize. I can nationalize. I can do whatever I want. Only to wake up eventually and see that the one thing they cannot control is the exchange rate, because this is the one thing. And so, to your point earlier, I think it's almost like from a game theory perspective, the game is designed to finish through this devaluation channel, because it's a trap. You know, you get trapped into taking these short-term measures. It looks like you're in control. It looks like you can contain them. They're easily abused, and before you know it, you have problems that are systemic, and then you're trapped, and you can't quite normalize things. And so we are now finally trying to normalize things, and we'll see whether we can do that or not. But that is the trade off, and how I think this movie ends. It's as I say in my book, you know, in the anti-bubbles. The last decades you can summarize as the transformation of risk-free interest into interest-free risk. This next decade, in my opinion, is about the transformation of systemic bubbles into stagflation, you know, which is this price we need to pay for the abuse and excesses that we've witnessed in the last few decades. So it's smaller growth, it's lower valuations, it's high inflation. I think that's kind of the better outcome faced with other more extreme scenarios that we hope we don't see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Diego, you write a lot about the Hong Kong peg. So how does that play into, let's say, the valuation of the yuan as well? You know, we've seen them try to defend that peg and they're just depleting their FX reserves. So how does that whole situation, again, kind of resolve itself?
Look, I think it's a very good case study of one of the biggest macro themes we've seen this year, which is what I would call monetary divergence. So, you know, you've seen the Federal Reserve fighting inflation, hiking rates aggressively, leading the pack, and basically sending rates, you know, towards a target of 5%, give or take, right? And as they do that, the dollar strengthens, and you know, there are casualties along the way of people who could suffer. You have other central banks that taking the opportunity or acknowledging the fact that they also need to hike a bit more reluctantly and slowly, like Europe, but also introducing things like yield curve control to prevent these hikes from blowing things up. And then on the third side, the other extreme or third group, you would have people like China, who are basically on the easing side because they have all these problems that they're facing. So this monetary divergence between the US and, you know, Europe, Japan and others, and then China, when you look at Hong Kong, it's kind of like Hong Kong is in the wrong bucket, because Hong Kong is, by being pegged to the US dollar through a currency board, they need to follow the monetary policy of the US to the basis point. And that means that Hong Kong, which arguably is geographically and economically and in many ways linked to China, it's being forced to hike aggressively. And there are plenty of reasons why I think this is unsustainable. I know the peg's been around for 39 years, almost 40. So a number of people in this call were not even born. So it's been around forever, literally. And it survived extraordinarily difficult times, you know, including 08 or 20, etc. But I think the things have changed. I mean, to put it simply, you know, markets are total return assets, right? So, you know, during Brexit, the sterling pound collapses, and suddenly real estate in the UK is very attractive and people want to buy it. And guess what? Real estate in sterling goes up, right? Because people think about, you know, these assets in their own currency or in total return. So what it means is, you know, you can actually let the currency do some of the work, or you can let the markets. But if you're going to keep your currency, you know, artificially high, or even have, you know, the Hong Kong market, one of the possibly most expensive, if not the most expensive real estate market in the world, good luck financing that at 4, 5, 6, 7%, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you have easily, you know, 50% downside in that market. Likewise, from the stock market, or the, you know, this is a country that was built as the third largest harbor in the world, you know, as a gateway to China. Now you have Shenzhen around the corner, like literally within stone distance. You have many other things, like used to be such an important financial hub, also as a gateway to China in some ways. Now you can actually go to Beijing or Shanghai. And needless to say, it was a place with rule of law, whereas an expat, maybe you could live a happy, you know, safe, free life, you know, and that might, may or may not be the case now. So I think as you add all these things, you know, you have the ego of, look, this is my peg. I'm going to keep it because I said so. But fighting that peg, I think it's unsustainable. So you are seeing, and you will continue to see, outflows through, you know, the imbalances in the currency and potentially speculation. But second, if we were faced with the question with a blank piece of paper, you know, if you didn't have the peg, would you peg yourself? The answer is categorically no. So you're effectively stuck into a trade just because you put on the trade. And so I think the right solution for Hong Kong, if you think about it, is let's do something about it. The question is what, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, the break of the peg, it's a very traumatic thing that could create and destroy a lot of issues. So this is something that you want to do in your own terms. And generally speaking, the central banks hate when the markets put them in a corner, and they will fight it. But the longer they wait, you know, the more U.S. hikes. I don't think China is necessarily going to get any better. In fact, I think it's likely to get worse. And so you're facing this dynamic where you could count the chips and say, you know, the biggest counter argument is Hong Kong has huge amount of reserves, over 400 billion, right? So at the current pace, you know, they could last 4 or 5 years, no problem theoretically. At the same time, you know, this assumes that the pace of outflows will remain as it is. I think it can accelerate significantly. And second, and most importantly, it assumes that you will use the last dollar in reserves, the last drop of blood, defending basically what's undefendable. So my sense is they will try to do these things in their own way, but it's a matter of when, not if, that it will break. Will it break and stay pegged to the US dollar? That's a possibility, that it could entail a 20-30% devaluation easily. Or you could have perhaps what in my view is the more likely scenario, which is, you know, they peg themselves to the yuan, right? At an elegant level of 7.85, which would be parity. So that would be like in maths, when you have this beautiful solution, right? It's an interesting way out. Mm-hmm. So anything can happen. I don't know. The timeline is unknown, but certainly I think the markets have been quite complacent. And basically neglecting the possibility as per the implied probability in these markets, and so we think it's a a way to play China devaluation and what is basically a very clear macro theme in with extraordinarily asymmetric risk reward. So it's a meaningful position where, you know, we're long options. So if nothing happens, we lost the premium. If it happens, I think it could be a meaningful binary event for on the right side, hopefully. But it's asymmetric by construction when you buy options and you risk that. So we'll see how it plays out. It's a theme that's been around for a long time. Many people are being very vocal about it, and the question is why now and how and when. But I think those conditions are there. And as I said, I don't have a crystal ball, but time will tell. But I think it's perhaps sooner than what some people might think. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you put it in the letter, that's really kind of an insurance and a matter of time situation. On the other side of that, Diego, do you still see gold as another one of those safe harbors in these conditions, let's say over the medium to longer term?
Absolutely. I think gold is an anti-bubble. It's a textbook anti-bubble. In fact, I think it's one of the anti-bubbles of the fiat bubble, fiat currency bubble. Obviously, gold has not done well in the recent past. I mean, the last few months since it made the highs during the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine, it's been pretty much one way. And we need to understand in some ways, you know, what's been driving the market. But it's been, much higher dollar rates, a much stronger dollar, and in some ways, inflation already, the expectations recently that inflation would be contained and under control and be more temporary. But I think gold, The biggest thing about gold is that it's physical. It is scarce, but within the whole universe of physical real assets, it has other unique attributes, which make it, in my opinion, one of the monetary assets of choice. So you have these two levels of A, it's physical, it's and B, it's a monetary asset. But I think there are plenty of catalysts and things that have gone to extremes. We discussed the dollar, we discussed the expectations of hikes, we discussed the benign expectations for inflation, all of which might turn around. Also the possibility of credit events, which I think are more likely than most people would think, and the implications for volatility and hostile markets. So overall, I think gold has the potential to do well over the medium term as these things reverse. But yeah, we just need to be mindful that markets find pain, and the correlation and the hedge of gold, it's likely to be a delayed hedge. So as things explode, like it was the case in March 2020, gold collapsed initially. People mm-hmm. were long, they were forced to liquidate. Any levered long or gold or silver suffered enormously. But then the response with more of the same money printing and debt, etc., can lead to this big move. So I think it's a delayed hedge that I think it's given us the opportunity to reload and continue to accumulate on the way down. But I think it's just one more player. I think we cannot, go one stream or another. I think it has mm-hmm. a role to play. I don't think it's the only asset that will play some sort of defensive power. There are plenty of others. And I think it's important to understand that the behavior of these pieces, as the domino effect that I call as pieces fall, you want to look for things that will behave differently through this process. So I like gold. It continues to be a position that we like. We've been, we have an extraordinarily asymmetric profile through options. And And yeah, it's been very difficult and frustrating for many people. I think, you know, we need to remain focused on the fundamentals, on the real drivers, on the real big picture, and play for the medium long term. And that means that we need to be very careful with leverage, because, you know, as people get too emotional and things, we start to introduce leverage into the equation, then pretty much by construction, you will be taken out, because leverage is the enemy of volatility. Again, my view is constructive towards gold, but I am, I think, realistic about, you know, what to expect and the timelines, and you need to be in a position where you embrace this volatility and these sell-offs as you look to participate in the long term. So I think in its right size, it will be a very valuable player in the portfolio. In the wrong size, it can be a very destructive player, because, you know, it can lead to forced liquidation and things that you don't want to do. You want to be in a position where you take advantage of those volatility and sell-offs rather than be taken out by them. Mm-hmm.
When does it tend to respond to a rate hiking cycle from your analysis of it, Diego?
Well, the simplest way is that the market tends to bottom as the rates peak. So I think one of the reasons why gold was under so much pressure is the fact that people were very confident that the Fed would continue to hike into Q1 next year. So if you were short gold, you were like pretty chilled, because it's like, look, I'm still a few hikes before we reach peak hike, peak dollar. The reality is, you know, things can change, you know, and any kind of problems in the markets that might lead to an early pivot, as has been the interpretation of the market, can lead to this rebounds. So that's the story. Is no one has a crystal ball. Do you have expectations? The market, you know, believes that, yeah, there are more hikes ahead. And of course, that's oversimplifying reality, you know, thinking that gold is just an inverse dollar play. It's significantly more than that. It has inflation aspect. It has credit risk aspect. It has physical. It has commodity. So I think oversimplifying reality is always tricky, but to the extent that we're looking at the high gain and dollar effects, I think the asymmetry was very clear heading into this last leg of potentially hikes, whether they're voluntary or those reversal might happen in a more involuntary way. But I think that's one factor to consider. Once again, don't get overconfident about your own models, because reality is different and positioning is very relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think the positioning, when you have such a strong trend, may actually have been a driver that has exacerbated this move down. And as this volatility or reversals take place, people are forced to buy back, and that contributes to the pull-up. So again, there are a lot of things that drive the short-term, long-term dynamics. And so, you know, generally speaking, if you understand these dynamics and you look at what I would call all the stars being aligned, so mm-hmm. you want to be in a situation where the market is complacent and is positioned short and vol is low and credit and inflation and stuff. As these things start to happen, and, you know, I think gold can show, you know, a more reactive response. And of course, there's the wild card of geopolitics, you know, which is something that it's an ever-present danger in the current environment, with some degree of miscalculation from Russia, where we are another. I mean, we had a scare recently of one of the allegedly Russian missiles killing people mm-hmm. in Poland and NATO, which was then attributed to a missile defense in Ukraine, and things, you know, escalated down quickly. But let's remember how these things can have played out, and be very mindful of what could happen. So I think geopolitics remains a wild card in both directions. There are risks on both sides, but there are many other things that play out. So, you know, like it medium long term, will remain volatile. Be very careful with leverage. But these models, I think, are pointing to a symmetry. I think in the one of probably a few hundreds dollars of downside, a few thousand dollars of upside has been my quick overall summary of gold, you know, and mindful that I don't have a crystal ball, I think that remains mm-hmm. the case.
Yeah, and thankfully in that situation, cooler heads seem to have prevailed. And hopefully that safer reaction continues. You mentioned being very active and taking a more, like when you're understanding volatility and taking the time to embrace and actively rebalance during those times of volatility, is that really the key to not getting killed in a lot of these markets, you know, being ready for those opportunities?
Absolutely. I think, look, I use the analogy that a portfolio is a bit like a football or a soccer team, right? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, you need players in your portfolio that will score goals, you know, like what we call strikers, you know, midfielders that get the ball, pass the ball, defenders, and obviously goalkeepers. And, you know, basically a lot of people have been playing this game with 11 strikers. You know, a lot of people were complacent about the fact that mommy and daddy, you know, like the referee would raise the flag and call offside every time the other team was attacking. And it looked like you could play this game without defenders or goalkeepers because why, you know, we don't need them. I think this new paradigm of higher volatility, higher inflation, higher risk effectively leads to a world that it's quite different. The next decade will be quite different to the previous decade. You know, this previous decade, again, it was buy the dip and one-way market and complacency and many things. I think this new paradigm is going to be significantly more volatile, more risky, more inflationary. And what it means is that, you know, when you build a team, one of the things you need to be mindful of is the risk of false diversification. And what it means is confusing a portfolio with a lot of things with a diversified portfolio. They're two different things. You know, I'm sorry for the bad example, but a portfolio of 20 cryptocurrencies is not diversified because ultimately they are all the same trade, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, what's very obvious with the crypto, it has been equally obvious with, you know, things that were historically uncorrelated, such as, you know, your 60-40 balanced portfolio, your equities and your fixed income, which were supposed to be negatively correlated, led to have moved with positive correlation and has led to hidden leverage because you thought you were diversified and you weren't, at least as much as you thought. So in that sense, the portfolio construction, in my opinion, is must embrace true diversification and understand it. And this is about the true behavior of assets. And that's why, you know, bubbles and anti-bubbles by construction are good teammates because they complement each other. But I think as you do this, the point on rebalancing and the point of embracing volatility is hugely important because ultimately what it does is it generates you know, incremental money, it reduces risk, etc. So putting it differently, you as the coach of the team, you need to decide, okay, what strategy do I want? Which players do I want on the pitch? How am I going to change them, right? So some people might think that the best coach is the coach who has a crystal ball and knows where the ball is going to be. I would disagree. I think the best coach doesn't have any idea where the ball is going to be. He's going to try to play his match, but ultimately you want to embrace that volatility. If the ball is up, you have strikers. If the ball, the other team attacks, you have defenders and goalkeepers. Mm-hmm. And is that, you know, save that the goalkeeper does, that passes the ball to the striker that scores, that is the idea. You know, if you have a portfolio where you accumulate artificially cheap insurance during very benign markets. And, you know, the ship hits the fan, and then you get this dynamic where you have distressed assets, but your insurance is valued a lot. Well, you should be monetizing your insurance to buy distressed assets. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, as the market becomes very complacent, you want to accumulate artificially cheap insurance, almost distressed insurance, right? Which you finance by monetizing complacent valuations. You don't need a crystal ball. You just, you know, in the middle of the night or in the morning, okay, S&P is up 20%. Oh, thank you. I sell a bit, buy insurance. And then the S&P is down 20%. Thank you. I'll buy a bit and monetize the other. And as you do that and you embrace this volatility, you know, effectively, what you find is that after a few cycles, you are in a much better position than you would have been had you just let these things play out. Because this is not, having insurance in your portfolio is not about mark to market. It's about, you know, capturing the opportunities in distress markets. And that's, you know, if you do the opposite, if you have no defenders and you're leveraged, then you're going to be killed because, you know, you have no defenders and the other guy just walks into your goal and that's it. Right? So I think embracing volatility, understanding false diversification, understanding hidden leverage through, you know, the impact of volatility, correlation, liquidity, and creating portfolios that are truly diversified and that embrace volatility, it's super important. And that's why, you know, our offering has like two legs. It has the goalkeeper on its own, which some people buy in their own size. But we also have that strategy is called Igneo. But we also have a strategy called Aqua, which is basically protected U.S. equity. So it's like, look, just switch your long-only equity for this. You're still invested in equities, but you're going to have some insurance inside of the strategy that will do that job of protection and rebalancing. And so I think this is a time where perhaps the future, I would strongly recommend that people have protected equity rather than just naked and protected equity, not only because of the risks ahead and the benefits of protecting the capital, but very importantly through the compounding effect and embracing volatility. And that's, I think, something super important as we navigate these markets of risk on, risk off, inflation on, inflation off, volatility on, volatility off. It's going to be a more permanent feature of the markets, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as many conversations as I have, I always really enjoy hearing about the way that you think about, let's say, the framework of where to rebalance and when, and how all of those pieces of the puzzle really work together to help not necessarily smooth out that volatility, but really take advantage of it for yourself, right?
Absolutely. And I think there's two main ways in which you can think about this rebalancing. One is, you know, I'm going to do it, let's say, every 5%. I do it. Or I'm going to do it every month. Or I'm going to do it ad hoc because I have my own signals. And you can spend as much time as you want. And I think people will do all these back tests that tell you that the optimal rebalancing strategy for the S&P would have been at, you know, minus 29% drawdown simply because the market bottomed at minus 29.1, right? Mm-hmm. You know, something stupid. Now, I don't think there is a magic formula. I never believed in magic formulas. I think you need, you know, something that will ensure that you are in the game and you're doing it at the right frequency and right distance. And so I think, again, if you look back and you rebalance too frequently because the market went down by 30% and you bought something at minus 10 and something at minus 20 and something at minus 30, you might look back and say, oh my God, I should have just let it run longer. But and many of the times the market is down minus 12 and it bounces to plus 20, right? And so you want to be in a situation where you just let the volatility play out. You embrace it. And if it's minus 10, thank you. If it's minus 20, thank you. If it's minus 30, thank you. If it's plus 20, thank you. If it's plus 40, it doesn't matter. And if it's minus 10 plus 10, minus 10 plus 10, thank you. So how, again, trying to be just too clever about this, I think might lead to over-optimization of the past, not the future. And so, you know, I think you just need at a minimum to rebalance every month. And then potentially have some triggers that might be a combination of certain targets plus other signals that you want to use. But at a minimum, I think, you know, a monthly rebalancing might give you that ability to capture certain moves. And again, I think the anybody who thinks or claims to have a magic formula, I think it's unconsciously incompetent. Because I don't believe in that. I think you need to, you know, basically understand all these factors at play and have a process that will capture the spirit in a way that you're disciplined. And if you, I generally say, you know, when you play too much by emotions, one way or the other, then you're likely to have, you know, the wrong behavior and so, or be influenced to outside of the right decision. So I like to find what I call the point of emotional indifference. And that's something that I think works very well for position sizing, right? If you are long asset X, you know, and you're constantly watching your iPhone or whatever, just every basis point that this thing is moving, you are likely trading too big. If you are overly happy or overly sad, you're likely trading too big. So I think you need to find ways in which, you know, market's up, I'm long enough that I'm happy, but, you know, market's down, I maybe have some room to add. And as it trades along the way, I will sell and buy, and I'm not married, you know, to this thing or levered in a way that it will destroy me. So I think, again, position sizing, rebalancing, emotional indifference, and being able to, of course, do your manual override if you decide that this is the time to rebalance. But ultimately, you have to follow a process. And most importantly, I think that any rebalancing will be better than no rebalancing. That's my take, provided your team has the right players. If your team has players that will converge to zero, then no rebalancing will ever help you. But to the extent that you as a coach pick the right team and rebalance assets that are generally doing their job. And if they're not, then you should just switch those pieces. There's no point having a useless goalkeeper that will kill you or bleed you to death. And that's the danger with some of the defensive strategies, like the VIX, you know, being constantly in the VIX on an ETF that is rolling in a negative risk premium game. It's 99% of the time going to cost you money because, you know, the negative risk premium requires almost perfect timing, and I don't think that's necessarily that feasible or possible. Or, you know, so I think you need to understand risk premium. You need to build the right team. Make sure that, you know, these things are going to behave the way we need them and want them to behave, and then let the team play out. But there's more, you know, some art or a lot of art and a lot of science. You kind of want both, but science is always better.
and not believing in magic.
Certainly not. I think there's no magic formula, for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the systematic formulas work because they understand risk premium. They understand who pays who and why, and asymmetry and percentages and stuff. So they're not magic formulas that discovered the universal rule of the world. I think they generally understand, in my opinion, the risk premium associated with cycles and stuff. And that's the source of you know, robust long-term returns, is understanding this risk premium. Otherwise, it's just a pure gamble. right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, the market trend has been clear for a while and feeds on stuff, and then anything works, right? That people are geniuses. And you could actually create, you know, even from a random walk, you know, price path, you could create three sharp ratio formulas that worked for that specific observation. So don't fool yourself. I think, you know, this is a multi, it's almost like, you know, I haven't used enough sporting analogies in this chat, so let's bring one. But it'd be like thinking that, you know, I have the magic formula to beat Djokovic. You know, it's like, okay, of course you need to serve at 220 to the line and return and run at super fast. I mean, yeah, you never miss a ball. So yeah, if you can serve at 220 and run and catch everything and never make a mistake, you beat Djokovic or whoever. But it's not like you know, that's tactics, that's strategy. You need preparation, but it's a game that requires many, many, many things to beat these guys. You know, just serving alone or no legs or no forehand. If your model has a hole, that the market will find it for you, just like in sports or in the market. So I think, look, it's a multidimensional game. There are infinite ways to make money and lose money. Be honest to your style. Have a process. Have discipline. And you know, it's not just about scoring goals. It's about defending. And there are things that work very badly in the long term, such as leverage and volatility and negative risk premia. So ultimately, I think rebalancing is one of those key components that people don't understand well enough, and that I think are very relevant to generate these superior long-term returns in a safer manner. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, Diego. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up today's conversation. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, it's been a pleasure. If anybody's you know, wants to follow more, can feel free to follow me on Twitter. It's Parrilla Diego, PRRLL, or LinkedIn. I have this newsletter that you've been referring to, which is monthly and free. So the Anti-Bubble Report, if anybody's interested, they can subscribe through LinkedIn. But yeah, I'm not that active publishing stuff, but I tend to respond to things. People may have seen quite a lot of responses related to the crypto side, which is something I don't really trade or do, but I have felt obliged to counterbalance the one-way street of over the last few years, to be honest, of one-way opinions with something that I felt was needed, and so in that sense I have nothing personal about against these things. I just felt that I had to balance that, but and you know, any feedback welcome. I hope people found it the discussion of interest, and feel free to reach out, and if people have more interest in the ideas or the strategies, it'll be my pleasure. But thank you so much for the opportunity, and best of luck and health to everyone.
Thank you so much for your time today, Diego. And as you mentioned, all those links, we'll have them down in the show notes. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.